Hello and welcome to Against the Law, the myth-busting ancient history podcast that aims to separate historical myths from ancient facts. I'm going to give you some hints on today's topics as best as I can. First though, let me introduce the podcast team. On the floor today we have Xenia, who's here to share some fun facts about ancient Rome, which wasn't built in one day. Maybe she can tell us more about how long it really took. Meg deserves her own column. Ironically, she's not concerned when things are all Greek to her. Yes, she's got all the info we need on the ancient Greeks. Barney has been known to bring the house down when he shares his knowledge about the ancient Near East. I'm sure he'll have a tale or two, for us today. And we have a very special guest today. When I found out who it was, I was totally floored. We've been getting on like a house on fire with academic, author and broadcaster Professor Michael Scott, who has kindly joined us for this episode on, you guessed it, ancient buildings. I'm Flo, and when it comes to history, I'm as thick as a brick, but I'm excited to learn with you today, so let's talk buildings.
So hi everyone, I'm Professor Michael Scott. I'm a Professor of Classics and Ancient History at the University of Warwick in the UK. And alongside being an academic, so doing my research on the ancient Greek and Roman worlds, I'm absolutely passionate about communicating the stuff that we study and that as academics, you know, we dedicate our lives to studying to as wide a range of people around the world as possible. And I've done this through books, TV shows, podcasts, radio programmes, and of course, through good old-fashioned social media.
Lovely. Well, it is lovely to meet you and thank you for joining us on the podcast. I'm very excited today to talk about architecture because for me, as someone who doesn't know anything about the ancient world, when I think of the ancient world, I think about ruins and I think about places that you can go and visit. And those are obviously buildings and not always homes, but temples and things like that. So I'm really excited for today's episode. I'd love to start, if I can, by asking for everybody's favourite ancient building, whether it exists still or not. Any takers for their favourite ancient ruins or buildings or homes or structures?
I've got mine.
Go on then, Meg.
Mine is a Mycenaean Greek building, and I've talked about the Mycenaeans before, it's kind of early Greek civilizations, and they had buildings called Megaron.
Ooh, is that why you like it?
Yeah, that's why I like it, purely because it has my name in it. And it's just a big, big hall, big palace thing, kind of rectangular, got some columns. Looks a bit like later Greek temples, like the Parthenon. But I'm just a big fan of them. I think they're really cool and massive, and we don't know much about them, don't have a huge amount of evidence, but I just like the fact that they're called Megaron. That's basically it.
A little bit of bias there.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Talk about normative determinism.
You've got to call it the Megaron.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, the film The Meg about the shark.
Oh, yeah. I thought that was about you. I thought it was a biopic.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of the vibe, you know, like a big old thing.
Fabulous. Have you got any other takers for their favourite ancient structures?
Might be slightly off kilter, but I thought you would be identifying with, you know, the Disney Hercules film and Hercules's love interest of Meg
that's true.
The quote where she says my name is Megara, but my friends call me Meg, or at least they would if I had any friends.
Meg, are we not your friends? We're just colleagues.
Yeah, you guys are my work friends.
Oh, dang.
To be fair, I mean, Meg is going to end up with a, you know, semi-divine heroic figure, you know, are okay, I think.
I don't need you guys. I've got Hercules, actually.
That is true. Yeah. Rough with the smooth, I guess. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way. Mm. Very well pointed out.
I should probably now, I'll make up for my kind of slight deviation towards Disney's Hercules, which, to be frank, I will do at any possible juncture, as it is one of my favourite films of all time. But your original question about buildings. Okay, so I guess my choice would be it's a obvious one. But if I can just put a flag up for the Parthenon, because I mean obviously it's still there and it still looks quite an impressive building. But I think when we get under its skin and you start looking at the really detailed measurements that have been done of the Parthenon, you realise just how absolutely extraordinary a building it is. And there are two facts about the Parthenon that, even though I've known them for years, every time I think about them or read them, take my breath away. The first is this, that there's not a straight line in the entire building. And so you know, in the 5th century BCE, the architects, using kind of their rudimentary tools that they had at their disposal, were able to work out that if they had built the Parthenon with straight lines, it would optically have looked weird to us because of the angle that we approach it and look at it from as we move around the Acropolis. And so across the sort of length of the Parthenon, there is a minuscule bend in every straight line, and we're talking across hundreds of meters, we're talking centimeters of bend, so that optically the thing looks straight.
So the columns on the Parthenon, they're not straight up and down, they actually sort of bulge out in the middle, a bit like a man in his 40s, and I say this with some personal experience who's sort of developing a slightly saggy waist, and that gives them a sort of more slender and less kind of dramatic and brutal kind of appearance. And this slight curvature, sort of architects talk about it as almost making the columns dance, you know, makes them feel free, like they stretch up to the heavens. And then there's this other really incredible fact about the columns of the Parthenon that always knocks me for six, is that every one of those columns also leans in just ever so slightly, so that if every one of those columns continued up indefinitely towards the sky, they'd all meet about a mile and a half above the Acropolis. So it's minute degrees of incline. But that design has been created, and all those columns have been made to lean just that ever so much, so that as a whole, the building looks less, you know, kind of squat and square. And it makes the whole thing, the whole Parthenon as a structure, feel like it's trying to kind of take off into the sky itself. And all of that was achieved 2,500 years ago by the architects who designed it.
That's so cool, isn't it? I read that as well about the meeting in the sky, and it makes you think, I wish they could have done that even. I wish it went up and up and up and into some kind of weird spaceship looking thing. I think that would have also been cool. But as you say, it was pretty impressive that they managed what they did.
But I'm liking your ideas for a script for Disney's Hercules 2, The Return.
Yes. Oh, it could be a kind of, you know, in Life of Brian, where Brian gets rescued randomly by those aliens. It could be kind of like that, just a random aliens within a film set.
That have actually always been concealed within the Parthenon, under the Acropolis, because they first visited over 2,500 years ago. And so the Greeks built the Parthenon over the top of the spaceship to hide them.
Yeah, you're speaking my language here.
I was just going to say, if we're talking about aliens, obviously, then there's an obvious potential favourite structure of Barney's that might come up.
Oh, please.
Go on.
So, with the question, what would be my favourite ancient building? My heart wanted to say the Tower of Babel, since it combines, you know, the ancient Near East with languages, which are two of my favourite things. But since that's not necessarily an identifiable ancient building, I will say the Great Pyramid of Giza, for similar reasons to those which Michael said about the Parthenon, actually, and just some of the mind-boggling facts about it. Because, you know, the Great Pyramid of Giza is one of the most recognizable buildings in the entire world. And to suggest that aliens built it, I think, is lazy, because it is insane. Some of the maths behind the numbers of blocks of stone and the size and the amount of time over which it was built just are truly mind-boggling. You know, it's supposed to have 2.3 million blocks of stone in it, and it was created for King Khufu of the Old Kingdom in ancient Egypt, and over the course of 23 years, which is the length of his reign. And if you were putting in, quarrying, cutting, everything like that, 2.3 million blocks of stone in that length of time, it would have to be one being put into place every 2 minutes of daylight for 23 years.
Wow. Oh my God. Wow.
You know, and so the suggestion that aliens did it, I've always found to be like, it does a huge disservice to like the miraculous human agency that's gone into this structure, because it is just crazy. And yeah, the fact that it's sort of like this recognizable icon of Egypt, kind of people aren't truly appreciating how truly incredible it is, because it's so recognizable.
Absolutely. Something that everyone's mentioning is like the amount of thought that goes into the sort of the mathematics of getting everything right and getting these measurements. And Michael, you're mentioning how it sort of tapers slightly at the top, and I think it demonstrates a huge amount of thought about how it will be perceived, not just like, you know, how impressive it will be, but they've put the thought into almost the psychology of how it will be perceived. Like, I always think, is it Michelangelo's David that looks a bit weird if you look at it straight on instead of from below, because the proportions are a bit off, his head's a bit bigger than it should be, because if you're looking at it from beneath, proportionally he looks fine. And it's that almost psychology of how you look at it for the first time and your jaw drops and you go, wow, this is incredible. And that's what I was thinking about, Michael, when you were mentioning how the Parthenon tapers very slightly, or you know, it proportionally it looks incredible, like it's about to zap off into space. And Barney, with you mentioning how incredibly jaw-dropping the mathematics going into it is, that's what I was thinking of. It's amazing. Xenia, we're missing your favourite ancient building or structure.
Ooh, so I think this will come as a surprise to no one. Hadrian's Wall.
Yay! Celebrating a big anniversary this year as well, Hadrian's Wall.
Where is Hadrian's Wall?
Oh, what a wonderful question, Flo. That was going to be my main thing. So the famous bit of Hadrian's Wall is up in northern Britain, from Carlisle to Newcastle is where it stretches. But actually, there's Hadrian's Wall all around the ancient world. There were some bits that were built out of wood, so they've rotted away. But there are other bits, like in the desert in North Africa, there's like a huge stretch of Hadrian's Wall there as well.
What? You're actually wrong, Xenia. I don't know if anyone's ever against the law, any of you guys, on a podcast before, but you're actually wrong. Because the answer to the question, where is Hadrian's Wall, is at the bottom of Hadrian's Garden.
Oh. Oh, dear.
But no, I think you may have mentioned before that it extends much further than we've possibly thought, and it blew my mind before, because I visited Hadrian's Wall, loved it, fell over, it was brilliant, got a scabby knee in Holt Whistle, would definitely recommend. But yeah, it just blows my mind that it's that extensive.
It's brilliant, and it's just so exciting the way it was built as well. So it is thought, one of the latest theories, is that Hadrian's Wall was actually designed by Hadrian himself. Now, he fancied himself a bit of an architect. He talked quite a lot with various intellectuals of his day, and architecture was one of his sort of side hustles. So it's thought that when he came up to visit Britain, he might have drawn up a blueprint for Hadrian's Wall. But of course, he really didn't have time. He was a very busy emperor. He had the whole of his empire to go and visit. So he didn't go down the whole wall, and obviously he didn't stick around for the construction of it either. So when the three legions that were tasked with building it actually started getting to work on it, they suddenly realised that all this wonderful plan that the emperor had drawn up wouldn't quite work with some of the parts of the landscape. So sometimes the wall sort of dips back, sometimes it juts very far forward. The thickness of it changes as you go along the wall. Sometimes it's very, very broad. Sometimes it's so narrow that maybe only two people could have passed each other on it. But one thing that is wonderfully regular is the turrets and the mile castles. So every Roman mile, there is, without fail, a mile castle. Every third of a mile, there's a turret. And every so often, these are not regular, there's a fort, a nice big fort. I went on a research trip, actually, along Hadrian's Wall with some of the big names in Hadrian's Wall research. I was very starstruck. David Rees and Richard Hingley and Rob Collins, Matthew Simmons, and we all went along and we had a little look and we thought, okay, how would they have communicated between the different turrets and the mile castles?
Oh, can we guess?
How do you think?
Either they had a Syrian archer who flew off an arrow the entire Roman mile all the way to the other turret and hoped it didn't hit anyone, but it would definitely alert you. Or did they light fires, but then on a bright day you might not be able to see them?
The beacons of Gondor.
Yeah, so that was a theory for a very long time, was that they did beacons, because that's like a known system in other parts of the ancient world. But...
Hang on, Zenia. Can I just say, I think aliens were responsible here.
I think so. I'm with you here. I think it's aliens.
So we were there in July. It was absolutely freezing, and it was so foggy that we couldn't see 2 feet in front of us. So windy that we couldn't even hear people like 10 feet away. I thought, goodness, you're not going to see a fire. You're not going to see a beacon in this kind of weather. So we thought that maybe there was a wall walk. Now, this has been debated for many years, but we think that actually they stationed people at these regular stations so that if a message needed to go quickly from one place to another, actually you could just run really quickly in between the turrets. And, you know, anyone can sprint a third of a mile fairly rapidly.
No, you're wrong. I cannot do that.
But yeah, I think it might have been a wall walk.
But how many people would you need then on to sort of man the wall?
The Roman Empire, Meg.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, it was fairly well populated though. Like, they had these massive fort settlements, and then they had 3 full legions up there, and each legion is 2,000 people. Plus, they had several auxiliary units from across the Roman Empire, and they had local recruits. So the Roman army was a massive employer up in northern Britain back in the day.
And you'd have a vicus nearby, right? Mm-hmm. Of locals.
Exactly.
You could probably recruit some sprightly young local to sprint back and forth. That'd be fine. Wow.
Yeah, I almost kind of feel sorry, right, for the people that they brought from other parts of the Roman Empire to live near Hadrian's Wall in rainy, cold Britain.
There's a guy that's been found not far from Hadrian's Wall who was born in Palmyra. And he seems to have ended up working with the Roman army as a trader in silks that he was selling to the Roman army for use in their banners and things. And the poor guy kind of ended up living sort of last year of his life kind of up by Hadrian's Wall. And what must he have thought sitting in rainy, cold Britain up by this big wall when what he'd been used to and grown up with was somewhere, you know, thousands of miles away in just a completely different world.
Not only that, but he's being fed all sorts of things like fermented fish garum and gross, nasty food. It's just, I had an idea at one point for a sitcom about somebody who got employment at Hadrian's Wall, and the concept of, like, just like you said, of people from these, like, from my perspective, quite exotic places where it's hot all the time, and you've got fresh fruit all the time, and it's beautiful, and the scenery is amazing, and then suddenly you're on a wall trying to keep out, you know, basically everybody north of the wall, and it's cold, and it's damp, and there is a bath. So I think I went to visit a bath, maybe at Vindolanda, can't remember, it was all a bit of a blur, I did scabby my knee. But that wasn't really exactly what people would have been used to from their home countries, and it's quite a strange situation.
The best you could look forward to was an invite from the commander's wife to her birthday party occasionally, like, woo-hoo.
Make sure you wear your nicest sandals, and of course all your sandals aren't nice anymore because the mud's getting in left, right and centre because of the rain that never stops. Oh, I hate it. And I live here.
I don't know whether this is appropriate speculation. I hope that it is, but it's not inconceivable that a refugee from Syria might find themselves in the north of England now. And it's quite maybe poignant to think that all the complaints of people in the UK who may not be particularly hospitable towards migrants, they've got form from almost 2,000 years ago of people from Syria already settling in the area of Yorkshire.
Possibly their very own ancestors from so similar true. Circumstances to those that they're probably not as hospitable about as they could be. Interesting.
It kind of makes, yeah, well, I mean, it goes back to all of these statements, like we've recently seen our dear Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, warbling on in advance of COP26 when he's not at a work event slash party, obviously, about, you know, how the Roman Empire was brought down because of immigration, you know, solely immigration and all of that rubbish that came out. And we see this periodically, don't we, from different people around the world where they sort of completely oversimplify and give this ridiculous one-sided picture of an event or a place or a happening in the ancient world that then is kind of twisted to make some kind of modern political point. And I think it's the job of people like us and of this podcast and of others to leap to the defense of the ancient world. And as Barney was just pointing out the kind of the complexities of the situation, oftentimes the fact that the reality was the complete opposite, and keep fighting to make sure the ancient world is actually used in a much more befitting way.
Hear, hear.
End of my stumped speech.
I'm going to drink that. To that. Absolutely.
Also, can I just make a joke? The lady at Vindolanda is actually inviting her friend to a work event in that tablet.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
I think that's been misrepresented in the press, and it's time to set the record straight.
It was bring your own bottle, wasn't it?
Yeah, I believe it was.
Actually, I'm still waiting to hear from Suvius Greyer whether or not it was a work event or a birthday party, but I'll get back to you on that one.
Oh, very good, Flo.
I'm trying.
I have a little Hadrian thing, if you'd like it, Xenia.
Sure.
I think Xenia's the one with the Hadrian thing, actually.
That's a big Hadrian thing. One of the biggest temples, Greek temples in the ancient world, they started to build it in the 6th century BC, which is when Athens was still being ruled by tyrants. It wasn't a democracy at this point. And then it kind of, for various reasons, wasn't built, and they stopped building it, and, you know, they never got round to it. Various things happened. And then it was finally finished by, guess who? Your man Hadrian.
Yay! Not the one that you can see from the Parthenon. You look down and you can see the temple still standing.
Temple of Zeus Olympius. Yeah, that one.
Yeah.
And it's massive. It's kind of, I think it gets called the columns sometimes because the columns are just so big. They're like 4 meters taller than the Parthenon's columns. And it's about, I think it's about 40 or 50 meters longer than the Parthenon as well. It's absolutely massive. And it's not as complete as the Parthenon or the Temple of Hephaestus, but it's a cool one. But I just thought that was interesting. So yeah, it took nearly 700 years for it to be finally completed by Hadrian.
Oh, blimey.
Hadrian was obsessed with Greece, and he that earned him the nickname the Greekling, Graeculus, because he was just really into Greek literature. He loved speaking Greek, and Athens was his all-time favourite city. So, yeah, he poured a lot of money into it. I can imagine him actually sort of turning up in Athens and being like, "What? You haven't finished it yet? You've had 7 centuries."
That's a point, though. That is a point about how long it takes to build things. Because where I was born in Salisbury, I remember as a child going to visit the cathedral and hearing about how long it took to build. And we've got cranes, and to be fair, it takes us a long time to build things anyway, especially, you know, the potholes around me.
I was going to say, 700 years doesn't sound too bad on current construction. I mean, look at HS2. I mean, are we going to do better than that? Go, Hadrian.
Back, Hadrian.
Absolutely.
Oh, well, while we're all still on the subject of Hadrian and the great things we admire that he built, I wanted to mention that Hadrian was a big lover of drains.
Yeah!
Drains, which I know we're all big fans of here. And, you know, I think it's fair to say that drains don't get the love and renown that they deserve, right? And until, of course, they go wrong, and then we all realise how much we need drains. But when Hadrian was in Athens in the 2nd century CE, and he was finishing off those big temples that had been hanging around unfinished for nigh on 700 years, he was also going, "You know what, Athens, you need a proper drainage system, and I'm the man to do it." And he did. And I had this rather bizarre, you can't really call it a pleasure, can you? But maybe an honour of some kind. When we did this TV series called Ancient Invisible Cities, of having to climb down to Paris, abseil down this tube sort of 14 metres underground to get to the remains of an ancient aqueduct that had been built underground in Athens by Hadrian during the 2nd century CEU. Now, it is in no way as plush as the big Roman aqueducts that you can have two or three people abreast walking happily down without sort of bending over or feeling kind of constrained and claustrophobic in any way, marveling at the nice, smooth, sometimes marble clad walls. It's nothing like that. It's a bit more of a kind of slap up job, but it's not his finest work, but it's still a really impressive achievement.
But he created this aqueduct that is still running today, and it runs into the city centre. And if any of you know modern Athens, or for listeners, next time you go to modern Athens, go to the very schisty upper class area of Athens called Kolonaki. And if you go to a place on halfway up Lykavetos Hill, it's a place called Vexameni Square, which is a very shishy place to go for a pre-dinner drink and sort of hang out in the square and look at the finest, most beautiful people of Athens kind of all around you. But underneath Vexameni Square today is a cistern that was created and built by Hadrian to store water at a nice height so it could then be fed into the Greek water pipe system when needed. And that cistern was actually in use from the time of Hadrian in the 2nd century CE all the way through until when it was finally decommissioned in the 1960s.
Wow.
And so then you think this is good, but then I had a chat one time with the head of the water board in Athens. And he admitted to me that basically they are still using the water pipe work put down by Hadrian in modern day Athens to get water around the city to the modern inhabitants. And they have no clue where these pipes are, half of them. They just know that they put water in one end and it comes out the other. And the only time they work out where these pipes are is when one finally breaks and suddenly water sort of is pouring out into the street.
So they dig down and they find the pipe that's gone wrong, and they investigate, and they obviously have to replace it. And then they mark it kind of in all the maps of the area and on the historical record as kind of, we found another bit of Hadrianic piping. So Hadrian is still basically running, not so much the drainage, but, you know, certainly parts of the water system of modern day Athens.
Well, that's my favourite thing I've ever heard. I love drains and I love sewers. And one of our Patreon supporters is going to be freaking out about this because she also loves drains and sewers. And I love that you can start a sentence with, I was having a chat with the guy, the head of Athens. What was it? What was the sentence you said?
Oh, the head of the Athens Water Board.
Yeah, just having a chat, as you do.
This is becoming a Hadrian tribute episode, isn't it?
I am in seventh heaven. This is brilliant.
Okay, at this point then, I think it makes sense for us to start thinking about our favourite things. At the end of every podcast, we have a reflect back on the things that we've heard about, and it doesn't have to be historical. It can be our chat about aliens, if you like, but it tends to be historical fun facts that we've learnt. We all take it in turns to say what our favourite thing is. And because you are our guest, I will let you go first. Although I do kind of want to have dibs on your drain story. So if anyone's looking at drains, I've bagsied it.
Oh, that's great. I think my favourite thing to be reminded of in this programme is that Hadrian's Wall is not just in Britain. And the fact that, you know, Hadrian, at the end of the day, well, he tried to build a wall around the entire world, which I think is, you know, it's admirably Hadrianic, if also just a little bit weird.
It is very ambitious, very eccentric. It's everything we love about Hadrian. In which case, Senya, I'm going to hop over to you because Hadrian's the love of your life.
Well, I loved Michael's fact about how the Parthenon, if you continue the columns, it will meet at the top. I did not know that, and that was really wonderful to imagine, like a giant hat on top of the Parthenon.
Yeah, is it like a mile and a half above the Parthenon, did you say, Michael, that it would be?
Yeah, it's something crazy like that. They incline ever so slightly that the building would have to continue right up into the sky, practically reaching into sort of Jeff Bezos's territory of outer inner space, something like that.
At some point it's going to collide with a red Tesla that's in orbit. Brilliant. So Meg, what was your favourite thing you've learned today?
Mine was also Hadrian related, actually. I really liked this idea of the wall runners. I think I could do that job, and I'm actually near the end of my PhD, so if it's still an option for me, I might apply to be a Hadrian wall runner.
Go for it. There's a big Hadrian conference happening this summer. Just turn up and be like, right.
All right then, so Barney, what was your favourite?
I will then have to take the wonky Parthenon. I like that very much, especially because I think, you know, this is an episode about buildings. And when we think of buildings, we think of straight lines, right? Especially in the modern world. And so to have the sort of the emblematic icon of Athens have not a single true straight line in it is a pretty great lesser known fact. Thanks for that.
I thought it was brilliant. And so with your fact, Barney, about the all of the work that went into the pyramids is just incredible. But I have to say, for me, predictably, drains is my favourite thing to hear about today. And I just love the fact that every so often, this ancient drainage system sometimes goes a bit squiffy. And they go, ah, so that's where it is. And that there's just a mystery water course underneath Athens. It's incredible. I love it. Thank you so much, Michael. I really appreciate you joining us on the podcast today.